Nerds, you're listening to an episode on the Nerdcore podcast feed. If you're feeling generous, please consider pledging to a tier on our Patreon at patreon.com/thenerdcore. We have tiers as low as $1 per month. Thanks so much, and enjoy the episode!
Let's just not act like that just happened. Welcome back to the Nerdcore Podcast, the podcast that reviews movies and talks sad nerd shit. I was not on the Nerdcore live show, overlay and stuff. No, I was not. You're lying to yourself. As always, it is the nerd that you're going to hear the host of the show alongside my wonderful co-host, Young Yoda.
What's up, everybody? And the second row, I didn't see shit.
Yep, I know. It was my fault. didn't... expect that to go down as I thought it would, but
man, you got everybody confused. They think it's a different day. I think it's like Friday or something.
Yep, it's barely the beginning of the week, but as always, it's a wonderful Monday. We are continuing on with our month, looking at the films of Federico Fellini as we look at In Half today from the year 1963. But before we get into any of that wonderful stuff, Brad, what's up? How you doing?
Doing well, Ro. Doing well. How you doing?
Pretty good, pretty good. Finished watching this film today. Watched And Life Goes On again. Love that. And I think if I'm not playing anything after tonight, I think I might just watch Through the Olive Trees or might wait for that tomorrow.
So what you're saying, it was a good purchase that you're really enjoying.
Yeah.
Enjoying like, that trilogy.
That trilogy, it looks beautiful on my TV. First of all, like those restorations, like they really didn't do it justice when watching it from the, from the Criterion Channel, unless, you got like a beautiful like TV and stuff, but
yeah,
you know, God, I was watching that on my, on my TV and it just looks absolutely beautiful, dude. So thanks for that. Cause it looks amazing. It looks amazing.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. I thought you would. It'd be one of those I was looking at it. And I'm like, I would buy this for me. So I know Raul would probably enjoy it.
I don't know why you didn't buy Taste of Cherry though. It's like $20 on Amazon right now.
Cause I'm cheap.
or you don't want to wait until like the last moment until you're gonna wait when it gets to like to like $40 and you're like, damn, should have bought it a while ago. I'll buy it right now.
It's like Ikiru, the Blu-ray's $40, and I'm just like, I'm just watching the Criterion Channel.
Yeah, it's just like some of them like I would want to have on here, but Ikiru is one of them that I do need to get sooner or later. Seven Samurai is like $37, I think.
I honestly want the Kurosawa box set, but the thing's like over $800 on eBay.
Yeah, that's an old box set too. So honestly, at the rate they're going, I really hope that they make a new Kurosawa box set soon because like they got to be working on putting those on 4K because like those have got to be getting that 4K restoration quality now.
I'd imagine so. But honestly, there's only so much you can do with some of those movies.
Yeah,
like there's some of them. There's only so much restoration you can do.
Yeah, I would. I wonder, first of all, like those negatives are old. Like are old.
Yeah, we're talking older than World War II. Old.
Yeah, so I wonder how much cleaning they need to be done. But
like I told you yesterday, there's a point where you're like. Is it worth it with the possibility of me just totally destroying this and being haunted by Kurosawa for the rest of my life?
Yeah. But we also know that, like, they also know that, if they were to release one, a box set, like, of course, people like us, we would,
Oh, yeah. That would sell out. It'd be like sneakers. It would just, you'd have a shit ton of resellers, and then you'd have us who just sit in there holding it.
Yeah, this one is okay. So this one, Ikiru is newly restored. It's a 4K digital transfer. Digital transfer, not an actual restoration. But it's still, I bet that looks beautiful from the Blu-ray quality. But
does Criterion have the actual like the originals? Negatives? Yeah, do they have those or? Are they like given those to do this and then have to give them right back to like the vault of Kurosawa's family?
I think they like, so first, what's it called? Of course, they go to the labs that they use to make these things.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think they kind of go back to the estate or wherever they're being kept. Sometimes I guess that they will be kept at those labs, the specific labs that they're being done. But yeah, I would hope that we would get a new box set soon because
and honestly, it might actually go back to the studios because some of those studios still exist in Japan, like Toho. Mm-hmm. Toho still exists.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I'm going to name one example, Drunken Angel. Mm-hmm. Drunken Angel is only available on Blu-ray. It's only available on DVD. It only has a high definition transfer. It hasn't been restored to 2K nor to 4K. That's one that I would hope like soon they could like get their hands on to kind of restore and you know, to give us that, what's it called, that restoration, because I would love to own that.
But that one definitely needs some
TLC. A lot of clean.
It needs some loving, caring, and some attention. It definitely mm-hmm. needs that, just because some of that film, it's really hard to see. Like, it's too dark in some areas.
Yeah, and also, like, what's it called, High and Low doesn't have, like, a 2K or 4K restoration.
High and Low actually looks
beautiful. Really good. But imagine a 4K, what's it called, of that?
Well, for really any of those. Although, Rashomon, I don't know. I don't know about restoring Rashomon completely, just because mm-hmm. I love those scenes of just, like, the rain and all that. Mm-hmm. And just the way it looks. Yeah. That's where we come back to like Amores Perros. Like, you don't want to do too much because that's a gritty movie. You kind of want to keep the grit.
You take away too much from the movie that suddenly, like, that's not even the movie that you watched.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or the movie you fell in love with to begin with.
Mm-hmm. I would love for them just to, you know, clean them up and, like, you know, of course, don't change up the contrast or anything. Just, you know, clean them up and, you know, get them to 4K transfer, because it would be really great to, like, get, because a lot of these, like, they were so, like, first of all, if I remember correctly, that box set is only DVD.
Mm-hmm.
It's on Blu-ray.
Yeah.
So, like, a lot of these could use that bump up in the quality.
And from what we've seen from Criterion, they take a lot of care and mm-hmm. detail, and they don't overtly change the film too much. They just mm-hmm. give the picture quality a little bump.
Like the film we watched today for today, that was the new restoration for In Half, which I want to say, oh yeah, ooh, because I remember the old, because I have the old restoration, mm-hmm. and it's a little, you know, it's a little dirty. It's like, what's it called? It's pretty, like, not too, it's not grainy, more say, like, you can tell that the negatives are, like, there's spots where the negatives are kind of dirty a bit.
Well, and from the beginning, it said the sound. They did a lot with the sound
as
well. And apparently the sound was off in places in the original.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I'm really happy with, so if, you know, I'm really happy with this one. This one is the restoration on Criterion Channel, because I think Criterion Channel is like only uploading like certain ones, because of course they're not going to give you all the new restorations, because then that would keep you away from buying the Essential Fellini box set.
Mm-hmm.
But like the Amarcord new restoration that I watched at MFAH, it was beautiful. It was beautiful. And I wish that was the one that we're going to get to watch next week, but this is the older restoration. But Criterion does some amazing work, and if you aren't on Criterion Channel, you're honestly missing out, because not only are you being introduced to some new films you probably never heard of, but also you're like, the quality that they put, the time and work that they put into restoring these movies and making them look, you know, basically like cleaned up and new, it's so much work. It needs to be appreciated. So without further ado, let's go ahead and introduce them to Federico Fellini's 8.5. 8.5, Otto e Mezzo, pronounced, what's it called, Otto e Mezzo, is a 1963 Italian surrealist comedy drama film directed by Federico Fellini, co-scripted by Fellini, Tullio Pinelli, Ennio Flaino, and Brunello Rondi, who, you know, of course, the same people that have been working with Fellini for the last couple of films. It stars Marcello Mastroianni as Guido Anselmi, a famous Italian film director who suffers from stifled creativity as he attempts to direct an epic science fiction film. It is shot in black and white by cinematographer Gianni Di Venazzo, and features a soundtrack by Nino Rota with costume and set designs by Piero Gerardi. Eight and a Half won the Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film and Best Costume Design, Black and White. It is also acknowledged as an avant-garde film and a highly influential classic. It was ranked 10th on the British Film Institute's the Sight and Sound Greatest Films of All Time 2012 critics poll and fourth by directors. It is listed on the Vatican's compilation of the 45 best films ever made. Best films made before 1995, the 100th anniversary of cinema. It is now considered to be one of the greatest films of all time.
Can we take a step back?
The Vatican.
It is listed on the Vatican's compilation of the 45 best films made before 1995. And we'll get into this because that's really fucking strange.
Edited by Leo Cattozzo, of course. What's it called? This one was not produced by Dino. Dino did not work on this one. This was Angelo Rizzoli. And it sits at 2 hours and 28. It says 138 minutes, but I think the version that we watched was two hours and 20 minutes, I think. Mm-hmm. I don't remember. I think with credits, it's like 2 hours and 20 minutes. 2 hours and 18 minutes here on Wikipedia.
2 hours and 19 minutes is what we watched.
Yeah. $3.5 million in rentals from Italy, I'm guessing. I don't know what else, what's it called. No other money is given in here, but it was, that's how much it made. And, of course, it's in Italian. But, this is, what's it called? Once again, this is the film that Martin Scorsese said that, you know, with the last one, he said Fellini landed on the moon with La Dolce Vita. Well, with Eight and a Half, he landed on Mars. And this is like everybody, not everybody, you know, there's a lot of people who regard a lot of his films, but this one is mostly the one that is echoed, you know. This is one of the greatest films ever made. This is one of Fellini's best work. You know, countless, directors that we love have, you know, gone out and said that Eight and a Half is one of their favorite films of all time. One of them for me being, you know, Martin Scorsese, but also like Stanley Kubrick really loved Eight and a Half. So, you know, this film carries a lot of praise. So, without further ado, Bradley, and of course, I've got my handy book from Carrera. We're going to read a little bit of that towards the end of the review, but first I want to hear from Brad. Brad, what's up? What did you think of Fellini's Eight and a Half?
I kind of got to echo with everyone else. This is superb. I like this one far better than I did La Dolce Vita. Probably a tie with Knights of Cabiria, though. Like, I love Knights of Cabiria. I just love that film. Just the whole simple story of it and everything. Because, again, we see Fellini through a lot of these films. He just gets more and more complicated, which isn't a bad thing if you can pull it off. La Dolce Vita, I don't think he quite pulled it off. Not like he did with this movie. This movie, like, I could follow. Like, I could follow him going into dream sequences, him going into, you know, flashbacks. And I really liked that he did that because it kept the movie interesting. And it's a long movie. Like, these are long movies. So in order to go back from what's actually happening to a flashback, to a dream sequence, you know, it keeps the viewer's attention and keeps it moving. So I don't really have an issue with pace in this movie.
Yeah. And he doesn't kind of pull it out of left field. Like, he literally starts the movie with a dream sequence.
Yeah. Like, which apparently is one of the most well-known, you know, openings of a movie ever. And I can see why. It's quite fantastical and just kind of crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is my second rewatch of this film. Of course, my first time watching this film was in my world film and film theory class when we were discussing surrealism, and we had, you know, done this film, and I watched it with, of course, my mentor, Dr. Carrera, and we discussed the film, and we were discussing it. And, you know, at first I was like, I don't know what the fuck I just watched, but all I know is that it's masterful. It's, you know, I am nowhere near the capacity to understand, the brain capacity to understand what's it called, a Fellini, and I was just like, this is amazing. So on a second rewatch, I echo that once more. This is incredible. I mean, it truly, I mean, to an extent, you know, a lot of Federico's work is autobiographical. And also, I also say that with a grain of salt because the man was a great liar. But
although I do think he brings this up on how this is about a director. I think Fellini at this time, he must have been having some.
Oh, yeah. So the story was, you know, of course, I've said it before, you know, what's it called? He was called after La Dolce Vita came out, you know, he fell under a pretty bad depression. What's it called? Started seeing a psychiatrist. And what's it called? He, you know, once again, like I said, take this with a grain of salt. The man is a great liar. He's been a great liar his whole life that he lived, an incredible life that he lived. And, you know, he created the script, and he created the script 2.5. But, you know, he had, like, all he knew is that his character was in some sort of rut. Like, he couldn't do something. He didn't know literally until the day that he was going to, what's it called, get ready to, what's it called, finish, the, what's it called, turn in that script. On the way there, it popped in his head, and he was like, it's about a director who doesn't know, who can't make his next movie. And, you know, it popped in there. Also, it was, you know, there was a lot of titles that were supposed to happen. You know, it was at one point, the first title, I think it was The Beautiful Confusion. But
well, here's another thing. What, like, they don't come out with, like, nowadays they have the title literally in the movie. Like, mm-hmm. Where does 8.5 come from?
So he named it 8.5 because it's his, what's it called? That's the number of films he's directed. So what's it called? If you go back, so Variety Lights is directed by him and another director. So that's half of a film. What's it called? And then you have, what's it called? The White Sheik, which is his first film. You have Ivitelloni, his third film. The second and a half. What's it called? And then you have, what's it called? Il Bidone, which is his third and a half film. You have, after that, you have, of course, Nights of Cabiria. You have La Strada. La Strada is fourth and a half film. You have Nights of Cabiria, which is his fifth and a half film. After that, you have La Dolce Vita, which is his sixth and a half film. And then you have two short films after that, which would what's it called? Seven and a half. And then what's it called? You have his segment in Boccaccio. What's it called? No, wait, hold on. Seven and a half. And then, of course, you have, what's it called? One of the short films is a segment in Boccaccio 70. And then, of course, you have, what's it called, 8.5, which was his 8.5 film.
All right. That explains it. And I find it very surprising that it took him 6.5 movies in order to strike gold. Like, that's some determination.
Yeah. You know, like, us looking at it, you know, we look at Cabiria and we think, like, you know, and if I would go and watch La Strada and all these other ones, depending on how I would feel about them, because I still haven't watched them, you know, depending, like, us right now sitting there, we would probably think, oh, these are great. I mean, what's it called? What was going on? Like,
it's like any other great, like Van Gogh, Da Vinci, mm-hmm. they don't get credit until they're dead.
Yep. Yep. And, you know, once again, it's like, when it breaks that myth of, like, you know, La Strada, Cabiria, those two had won, you know, the foreign language film. Like, even if you win that Oscar, like, it still doesn't save you from the box office.
No.
Nowadays, what's it called? Now, like, if, what's it called, the film gets an Oscar, it's called, once it's re-released, then it makes its money in the box office. But, like, mm-hmm. back then, it was like, you know, cool, but still, it kind of sucked.
Yep.
What's it called, to some people? And, I will say, though, what's it called? First of all, you know, before I say anything, I did a pretty cool essay about this movie, a video essay. If you want to go check it out, on my personal YouTube channel, the link will be in the video and in the audio descriptions. But I got to say that, you know, I believe him when he says that most of his work is semi-autobiographical. This 100%, you know, also, you know, having, what's it called, watched, you know, of course, the what's it called, the interview with Milo. What to go with what was your first name? Sandra Milo. But also, you know, knowing the tumultuous, you know, kind of a life that he had, a marriage he had with, you know, Messina, and all those things that were going on. But, you know, you can tell that the film, you know, is so, is like, it is semi-autobiographical. But there was something that, and this is the first thing that I'm going to bring up. What's it called? I do want to say, first of all, right off the bat, I love Mino Rota's score in this film. It's beautiful. You know, that's nothing new. Like, honestly, I'm going to keep on saying that for like the next couple of movies because I love his score so much. But, you know, it's so, what's it called? You know, Wes Anderson always works with Desplat, you know, because Desplat and him work together all the time. They make great, what's it called, scores to accompany their films. But truly, like, you think about it, like, you know, I cannot picture, you know, Federico working with anybody else but Nino. And he worked with Nino up until the day that he died, you know, until his death. And I got to say that for sure. The cinematography is incredible. I mean, once again, another great, what's it called, great framed film. But what did you enjoy from Eight and a Half, Brad?
I enjoyed the truth kind of within it all. And mm-hmm. You said Fellini's a major liar, which the director in this is portrayed as that, but his truths come out. So yeah. I really enjoyed that, and I'll get into that in a minute. But another thing I enjoyed is I think we have another director-actor like team up that is really great to see. Because, you know, how we go on Kurosawa Mifune.
Yeah.
I think Fellini and Marcello, that's another one of those great team-ups that's happening and that we're seeing. Because that, I don't know how in the previous movie, La Dolce Vita, people were saying, oh, it should have been Paul Newman. Like, Marcello, like, just steals, like, mm-hmm. the scenes. And he's just great on screen.
Yeah.
But I also really enjoyed... And I'm still trying to figure this out on the sentence. It is listed on the Vatican's compilation of the 45 best films made before 1995 when this whole film skewers the Catholic Church. Yeah. He literally goes after them in ways. In one scene, he's like, you know, in life, you're not meant to be happy. It's like, fuck.
That's what I was like looking at throughout this whole thing. Of course, like, first of all, he blames the Catholic Church for him growing up with so much sexual repression, for Guido growing up with so much sexual repression. He what's it called? He attacks the because of censorship. He has it for all these things. Like, you know, before the movie even has to get made, he has to go to a deacon. Like, yeah. And us looking at this now, instead of us being alive then, we look at them, we're like, that's so stupid. Like, the church should never have any say in that stuff. You know, they should not have to meddle their fingers. But back then, those were the trials and tribulations that you had to go through.
And back then in Italy,
yeah,
which, you know, because major hub of the Catholic Church.
Because, what's it called? The church didn't stop having a hand in censorship until the early 70s. They weren't gone until the early 70s.
And they're probably still there in some form. Honestly, mm-hmm. in some form, at least over there, I'm sure.
They stopped having a big thing in state censorship, you know, after that. But, like, you know, in a way, still, I would imagine that it was still, like, a societal thing to have to, like, look down on, you know.
Which you get that in any religious community. The Baptists have it, you know.
Yeah.
And they have the websites where you can go on and see, is this suitable for children and all that. Yeah. So, yeah. So it's a revolving thing that a lot of religious sects do.
But God, is Marcello incredible in this. I mean, I adore him in La Dolce Vita. But in this, you know, there's a lot of things different between this film and La Dolce Vita. Of course, you know, Marcello plays such a different character in La Dolce Vita. But in this character, I think he really shows off more of those chops. Like, he really, like, the body language and the facial language that he can present on so many moments. And I point to a specific scene where he's in the theater doing the test screens.
Mm-hmm.
His face constantly reading, like, I'm looking at this. I don't even like what I'm looking at, but I can't tell him that I don't like it. And I don't think I'm going to do this. I hate that I'm doing this. And, like, the fact that his wife is there and he's like, I hate that my wife is looking at this. And I hate the way that I'm making my wife look. And I can't do anything about it because at the end of the day.
Literally, there's a test screening in there for the role that basically fits his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, what are you supposed to say to that? Of, like, this is how I feel, and I just can't tell you that. So I'm putting it on the screen for everybody to see.
Yeah. And of course, you know, he has mistresses and he has various women. He has a mistress, he has a wife, and then he has these appearances of women who he believes to be the ideal woman for him.
And it's so autobiographical that the mistress in the movie is actually Fellini's mistress for 17 years.
Yeah. Yep. I watched that. It was I thought it was beautiful at the end how she was like, you know, and there's some stuff I want to keep, you know, to myself because it was, you know, they keep it mysterious, but like, you know, I think that those are memories that I want to keep for myself.
And you know, it was different times and we don't know what his and Messina's relationship were at that time. And if that was allowed, honestly, I can't tell, but she really did come off like she really did love him.
Yeah. I read that, you know, that Messina was, what's it called? Detailed him as a long suffering of, you know, and I'm guessing that she wasn't a fan of those affairs and all. And I mean, especially if you watch, you know, Julia the Spirits, which I need to watch. I watched like 15 minutes of it. By the way, I think that was his first film in color, which is beautiful.
Just the scenes that they were cutting into with that interview, just like, dang.
It showed that, you know, Messina was like, you know, yeah, she, what's it called? She did not like those affairs. And, but, you know, you got from this, you got this kind of feeling from Milo, that Milo, Sandro Milo, that, you know, like, wow, like, you know, she loved him and he loved her. But this, he was a man who was like, so very complicated, you know. He was a great liar. He was a great director. He was a great, what's it called? He was a loving, what's it called? A loving partner, but he wanted to express his love with many people. And of course, I know he wouldn't want to talk. So what's it called? For those of you who don't know, what's it called? Of course, and this is public knowledge, but you know. Messina and Federico's. First of all, Messina had miscarried the first child that they tried to have, and then the second child, Federico, died 11 days after being born. So he never talked about, you know, he never in interviews when they wanted to talk about the child, he would never talk about it. So I think a little bit of that was, you know, kind of like a little bit of being. Repressing of emotions about something probably one of the hardest things.
Serious depression, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. And the man did not hide the fact that, you know, that he had his bouts with his mental health. I mean, you know, that story, whether real or not, you know, he went to a psychiatrist for a psychologist for a long time. And, you know, it shows in this movie, like 100%, that this is a man who, like I said in my video, I say at the core of it, he wants to be happy. He wants to be happy, not just in his career. He wants to be happy in his life. He wants to be happy in his marriage. He wants to be happy in his friendships. He wants to be able to have healthy relationships with those around him. But he seems to keep fucking that up for himself.
He doesn't know how to go about it.
Like, yeah.
And we kind of see in La Dolce Vita is Marcello wants the same thing. But at some point, he just quits on that idea and does a spiral. Whereas this... he doesn't really quit on the idea, but it continues eating at him until the point where he quits.
Yeah.
And we'll go into the ending scene because shit, after I watched that, I was already DMing Raul going, well, you think he took some inspiration from this and that? And we'll get into that,
though. Yeah. So what's it called? Of course, Dr. Carrera in this book, he says that, much like Guido, he also talks about just the importance of women in the films of Federico Fellini. But like Guido, much like Marcello in Dolce Vita, he's a character who constantly wants to go through like a metamorphosis that is not attainable. You know, Marcello in Dolce Vita, he goes through a metamorphosis, but it's not the metamorphosis that he wants. And he goes through one where it leads him down a bad path. In this one, he wants to go through this metamorphosis. The only way to achieve that metamorphosis was through killing himself, but
supposedly
the women in this film,
that one supposedly,
yeah,
because we don't know if that was
I'll read you a paragraph from here in a bit.
Okay,
but you know he also details about how the women are kind of figures of like these incredible figures of something that is so unattainable to the men in the film. of how like these women have things figured out, and the men are constantly trying to find something to transfigure into, but the women are constant figures of being like being kept together and figuring everything out, being figured out, and you know, just what's it called, being these unattainable objects of desire for the men in the film.
Well, I mean, you had the whole harem scene where, you know, it was him trying to control them in a way, and that just, he figures out that's not going to happen. One of my favorite scenes in this is with La Seragina.
Oh, yeah.
That flashback to his childhood. He's doing the rumba, and he gets so in trouble for that.
Yeah.
And, but I just feel like, you know, that's where he gets his first taste of, like, you know, a female, and he's like, and then I don't know, was he in an orphanage? Was that what that was?
Well, I think it was like a boarding school or something,
like a boarding school where all the females are just doting on him and taking care of him, and that's really what he wants. And he just wants to have all these females just taking care of him and dancing, basically.
Yeah. So what's it called? Of course, Seragina. For y'all who don't know, what's it called? And of course, we don't do spoiler warnings with films prior to 1969. Seragina was a prostitute who lived, what's it called, on the beach, because she was a prostitute mainly to soldiers who were coming back from war. So what's it called? She is also this kind of like goddess of sexual repression that is kind of being like what's called shown throughout the film. And here I'll go ahead before we anything else you want to go before we talk about like that ending, because you know there's. It's a pretty hefty paragraph that Carrera kind of goes into, but it's really interesting.
I mean, Raul, there's a lot in this film
to
take in, and we just don't have the time for that. This is one of those that I would choose.
Cinema condition.
Yeah.
Because there's so much, like, you know, just there's so much kind of layers through this film, and I'm telling you that it's just so beautifully written and beautifully directed by Fellini. And you know, a lot of people will be like, oh, I hate when movies kind of go back in time and stuff. I'm like, I think here it's like it works perfectly.
It works well, because if you just had a linear story, I think the pacing would be so off. It's a 2-hour 19-minute movie. It would just feel long. But with these flashbacks and these dream sequences interspersed in it, you forget all about the pacing and you just continue to watch this great movie.
Yeah. All right. So I'm going to read a couple of paragraphs here, because I really do think that it's really interesting what Dr. Carrera brings up in here. Of course, this is from the book, Fellini's Eternal Rome, Paganism and Christianity in the Films of Federico Fellini by Alessandro Carrera. Please go pick it up. I believe the paperback version's already up, so you don't have to pay $100 like I did. But like, you know, if you do pay $100, it's a damn good book. But he says, so he begins here, he goes, 8.5 begins with Guido's dream of flying out of a traffic jam. On a seashore, a counselor on a horse with a mark on his forehead has given him the appearance of a priest in some Egyptian esoteric cult. Orders an associate of his to yank the rope around Guido's ankle that still connects him to the earth. The rope was not there when Guido had started floating in midair. Down for good, the counselor says. Guido falls back into the sea, gasps, and wakes up in a spa hotel bedroom, suddenly invaded by doctors and nurses who ask him how he feels and take his pulse. The umbilical cord has not been cut. Guido was not reborn, and perhaps he was never fully born in the first place. Towards the end, when the pressure to make the film the world is expecting from him has become intolerable, one of the production assistants, played by Cesarino Michele Picardi, whispers to Guido that he will find a gun in the right pocket of his jacket. Guido crawls under the table of the press conference, and amidst the insults of the crowd, calling him clown, he shoots himself. Another daydream is Guido fantasizing about suicide so he can continue his dream? Perhaps not. Guido is no longer between two worlds, in between two deaths. I'm guessing that's what the French translation means. My professor speaks Italian, French, and English. He is dead, truly dead, like Cabiria, and ready for the eternal life. Instead of it was only a dream, now I can wake up he can now say it was only life. Now I finally can be. I can be dead. The happiness that suddenly seizes him makes him feel warmly again towards the real people in his life as well as his fictional characters. Weedle finds out that it is right to accept and love them all, and that is a very and that it is very simple too. Love is so simple, says Garance in Marcel Carnet's L'Enfance du Perdu. I think that's how you say that. 1945. Everything is good, everything makes sense, and everything is true. Or is it? In fact, everything still looks confused, but this confusion is me. Not as I'd like to be, but as I am. He says to Louisa, Louisa is his wife in the film. Life is a celebration. Let's live it together. Accept me for who I am, if you can. With the entrance of the clowns, the film, the real one, can now begin. A film that can only take place in paradise. Or, if we are not ready to use that word, the eternal life that Guido has fashioned for himself. In the magic ring of the circus, nothing that is not good, sensible, true, and confused, the vitally confused, will ever happen. But let us be clear. The conclusion of In the Half is aesthetically gorgeous as it is ethically ambiguous. In a way, I agree with Dr. Petter. I do believe that he killed himself. I believe that he killed himself, and the ending that we see on this movie is the life that he wanted. He wanted to expose himself and tell everybody about how he was feeling, you know, and be able to the dance of macabre.
Well, and he wanted to be free. Throughout this whole movie, he's literally saying that. He's saying that to everyone. He wants to be free. He wants to be happy. And I think he killed himself, because when I first saw this, I even sent to you. I'm like, did he take a little inkling of Bergman there?
Yeah.
With the macabre dance of the Seventh Seal.
Dance of macabre.
Yeah, which you know, that's death. That is how Bergman portrayed death in the Seventh Seal, is all of them died of the Black Plague and they dance off into paradise or wherever they're going. And that's what I get from this. I get he really killed himself at that conference.
Now, I mean, you know, we're not alive to Federico's not alive for us to ask him. But, you know, of course, Federico was a major fan of the circus. He loved, I'm not going to answer that. What's it called? There, you know, he loved the circus. And this ending is probably one of the best inclinations and, you know, descriptions of the circus. He kind of ends it with a circus. You know, everybody's kind of dancing, and he even sees his parents. His parents have been dead for a long time. You know, and then, like I was telling Brad, like, he died. And this is him in his, you know, in his paradise, where he can finally, you know, have the happy marriage that he wants. He can have the happy friendships that he wants. In this reality that he's in, he doesn't have to talk to his producer about the film, because the film is off and his producer understands what he's doing. In this reality, his parents are there and they look at him, but they don't really want to talk with him, but you know, they're there, you know, and especially in this reality, he's happy. He's happy. He's what he's wanted to be for a really long time, and he can dance and sing Kumbaya, and they can go off into the sunset.
Sorry, I was deleting that comment. But that is how I saw this. I saw this as just as the Seventh Seal ended, this was the way this ended, is him finding happiness finally in every aspect of his life. And the only way he could do that was in death.
Yeah. And this was masterful. I mean, there's so much going on here that, like, you know, there's like big pieces of, like, I could spend an hour discussing about the Sarangina and what she represents and all that. You know, I could spend like another couple of minutes discussing even more of this film. But
when I bring up the Bergman thing, I'm not like trashing Fellini for, you know, maybe taking that and using that. I mean, I have to trash Tarantino all fucking day for everything he's taken.
Did you find the scene that he took away from here?
I didn't see the Tarantino one.
When they're dancing, the American actress and the old man. The one where the old where the girl's going like that, and he's going like.
Okay.
That's so from
was the twist. Okay.
Yeah, that was from what's it called? That was what's it called? He took to replicate. He replicated in Pulp Fiction.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't notice that first, but I didn't doubt Tarantino probably took something from this.
God damn it, Eric.
But yeah, just to go back to the Bergman thing, I thought it was a great way to end it because it anybody who's a cinema fan would get it.
Yeah.
They would get it immediately, especially in 63, Bergman's Seven Seals was in 57, probably one of the biggest movies at that time. People would get it. They would get like, this dude is dead.
Yeah,
he's gone. Yeah.
And I gotta say, just what's it called? That it's one of my favorite endings. I mean, just the music alone. You know, I love it. You know, it's
well,
it's
and then he's representing because that little boy pops up like throughout the whole movie. That's the representation of him.
Yeah, that's him
leading the circus.
Yeah, and you know he's. And what's it called? We ended with that man, and it's just Federico's, you know, his eye, his the way that he conveys his messages are so, you know, like I said, they're fantastical. They're filled with so much whimsy and but like, you know, they're such fantastical and whimsical messages. But like ways of presenting them, but they're like really, you know, morbid.
And just the way they're presented, just what's on screen, like the giant framing for the spaceship.
Yeah,
that's fucking ridiculous. It was kind of like the giant light in La Dolce Vita.
Yeah,
it's like kind of ridiculous. I mean, but it works. Mm-hmm. It provides a message on just the scale they're looking at and what exactly he and it brings you into. The main characters, what he's having to deal with is all this money has already been spent and he has no story.
Yep. And he has nothing. And he doesn't know what he's going to do. And he has to just, what's it called? Kind of accept the fact that and probably that's where his career dies. You know, like he has to kind of accept the fact that like, hey, he just lost, he's going to lose a producer. He's not going to be able to work for a bit. And it's like, well, because I just couldn't get it. I couldn't freaking get it. Like, I just didn't have that idea. And in a way, that's like, you know, it's in a way that's Federico's autobiographical work. But in a way, it's also kind of detailing like one of the biggest fears of a creative, you know, having all these resources with you. And then at the end of the day, whether you sit down at that, what's it called, at that music studio or you sit down at your art studio, that idea that you have, you just cannot put it on paper. And you just can't. You can't. And it just won't come out. As hard as you try, it just won't come out. So, Brad, what are you going to go ahead and give Federico Fellini's 8.5?
But before I do that, I wanted to ask, have you seen on Twitter, the Hayao Miyazaki, his writing or trying to write something?
He's
I only got one page written today. God damn it.
Yeah, I love that. I love the pictures that have been coming out. Thank you to Twitter also for giving me a picture of Andrei Tarkovsky and Federico Fellini, you know, in the same room. Also one of Kurosawa and Fellini. God, I can just imagine the conversations that were being had.
I mean, even the picture with Lucas and Spielberg and Kurosawa, it's like, like what the hell did they talk about? Like,
it's grandpa and his kids.
Yeah, pretty much. Grandpa and
his grandkids.
That's really what that is. But for 8.5, this movie's great. I get why it's ranked in top list all over. It doesn't feel like 2 hours and 19 minutes. It really doesn't. Because the way he intersperses the flashbacks and the dream sequences keeps the pace rolling great. The framing, certain parts of this film are just beautiful. I can't find anything wrong with this movie. It's a 10.
Yep. Gets a 10 from me too. At this moment right now, because I haven't rewatched Mamma Mia, that will be for next week. This is my favorite Federico Fellini film with what's it called? With Nights at Caviria, right? What's it called? Well, right now, if you look at my list on Letterboxd, it's this one, Mamma Mia, Nights at Caviria, La Dolce Vita, and Roma, which is a movie that we're not watching this month.
I really do enjoy Nights at Caviria though. Yeah. Because if somebody asks, like, what Fellini movie should I watch? Yeah, you know, what should be my first watch? Start with Knights of Cabiria, because that is straightforward and just fucking good.
Yeah, so fucking good. But we'll see where Amargord lands. I really did love Amargord, but that one holds a special place in my heart because it was my first screening in 35mm, and it also was a movie I got to watch with Gio and a lot of my friends. So, you know, I that one kind of holds a special place in my heart. But yeah. What's it called? Before we go ahead and I've got a raffle to finish up here. What's it called? If you're a patron, you were entered into a raffle for my Parasite Blu-ray that I'm giving away because I now own the Criterion version. And yeah, let's go ahead and see who wins this. I put you all in names, and I've got one. If the person doesn't want it, they'll let me know, and then we'll have to reshuffle these out and go ahead and put them in. So the winner of the Criterion, what's it called? Not Criterion, I'm sorry, not Criterion. The winner of the Parasite Blu-ray with only the Blu-ray, no digital code included at all, is... Wow. Gio. Giovanni Howard.
Can we just pull another one? Because we know he doesn't want it.
He is kind of interested in it.
Oh, okay, but he won it last time.
No, he won the Lahain DVD.
Oh, okay.
So I'll talk to Gio. If he wants it, he'll get it.
Okay.
But we'll be back next week to do another recount if it happens. But yeah, Gio is the winner of the Parasite Blu-ray. You want to be included in spontaneous giveaways because of stuff that I have. What's it called? That I don't want to. What's it called? Giveaway. You can get a bunch of cool stuff.
I think you need to show the cup and show them all that, like, all the papers are in there.
Yeah. All the papers are there. It was in my cup. What's it called? He won. So, what's it called? As always, I want to thank you all so much for stopping by, Eric, Luis, dude that asked that weird question. Anybody else who was watching? As always, I want to thank our wonderful Patreon supporters who help us make this show possible. Without you all, nothing is able to be made here because you all helped us get a lot of this gear. As always, I want to thank our wonderful producers, writers, and showrunners. As always, our wonderful associate producers, Cassie and Sarah, thank you so much. And our wonderful executive producer, Shane.
You follow our friend Shane at twitch.tv/XSRK or on Twitter at @XSRK_. Love you, Shane.
Love you, Shane. And as always, our wonderful, what's called, writers, BrownRice96 on Instagram, Twitter, Twitch, YouTube, wherever you can find them. Thank you, Bryce, for being a writer of the Nerdcore Podcast Network. And also our wonderful Tony.
Hey, Tony.
At Real Nerdy Dad on Twitter. Thanks, Tony. What's it called? I got to get in contact with you about Earth Girls Are Easy so we can do that episode. But without further ado, of course, thank you to our wonderful showrunner, Tamor23. Tamor, this has been a really fun month, and I hope that we've been making you proud with the content we're bringing up, and it's been a lot of fun conversations being had. So without further ado, let's go ahead and send them out, Bradley.
All right, Ro, and being host as always, thank you to all those who join us in chat, even that one weird dude with the weird message. Thank you to all our Patreon supporters, all our listeners. We appreciate each and every one of you. And to end this, I guess what I'll say is, you know, do some yoga, breathe, Tai Chi, something, drink some tea. Don't let the stress get to you.
Never let your mistress be in the same city as your wife.
That's a good one, Ro.
Be better at hiding your affairs, dude.
Or maybe just don't have mistresses. That is 2020 or 2021.
A lot of marriages end in divorce. Just get a divorce. You can do all the fucking you want.
Pretty much. So with that well said, and all, Young Yoda out.